hasn't seen, and what Janine decided to base this entire series around. We're closing out the game movies series this week with this movie that really I probably should have watched up to this point. There's some significant stubbornness here as well, given the fact of the name of this movie is different to what it would be in Britain, although the movie itself doesn't change name or change title at all, which I think is a little bit confusing, given the fact that the game the movie is based on has a different name in Britain. So I don't know how well, you know, it may have done upon release and people going, wait, what's this? Is this that? I'm not sure if this is that, because it's got a slightly different name and it's confusing and it's wrong, Janine.
Well, I wonder if it was a graphical thing, perhaps, because, you know, they have all those playing cards in the credits, so I don't think they could do a whole version where the cards did not say Clue.
Probably. But I'm actually really glad that I have watched this movie now, because I think, to be honest, it's one of those that you feel like you get berated for not watching. I think simply because it is a movie of a certain time, of a certain era, and perhaps of a certain level of whimsy that people who grew up in this movie will just be like almost shocked and appalled up to the point of condemning somebody to death if they haven't watched this movie, because it feels like that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I don't like that about some people and some movie conversations, Janine.
They yeah, it's very
feel
harsh.
Bad about it's very not harsh. Watching movies. Even though, why would I have ever watched this movie unless it had have come on television? I mean, admittedly, I feel like this is a movie I've waffled on for the intro of this.
Well, no, I feel like this is a movie you probably would have watched. Like, it seems kind of like a movie you would like. I don't know, for whatever reason, it gives me vibes of Bugsy Malone. I think just because of the style of it just kind of reminds me of that in a way.
In a strange way. Yeah. I kind of understand what you mean. I mean, it's not at all like Bugsy Malone. We are talking about the movie Clue today.
Yes.
Or Clue colon the movie, which I have to pronounce it as colon these days because Janine shouts at me on Monday Madness if I pronounce it colon as it's actually pronounced.
Colon, yes.
Clue from 1985, based on the board game of Cluedo, which is its actual name, as we all know, because it's a play on the game Ludo, which you don't have in the US because you don't call Ludo Ludo. I actually did learn that Ludo is the Latin word for I play.
Oh.
So that's why Ludo's called Ludo and Cluedo's called Cluedo because of Ludo. Not just Clue, because you have to simplify everything, don't you? American.
Yeah, but I think it makes more sense because Cluedo is not a real word. It's just a word meant to rhyme with a word to evoke another game.
It's meant to be a joke.
Well, it's not funny.
Well, it is funny. I think it's very funny. It's also a British game. So,
yes.
Set in Britain, made originally by British people. So,
who makes this game? Because I was telling you that in the credits, when I brought this movie up to you to do it, of course you had your whole, actually it's called Cluedo kind of debate.
Yes, which
with
I have
you,
to
right?
open this show with.
Say. Yes, of course. So when I was watching this movie and then I saw in the end credits, it did actually say based on the game's Clue by Parker Brothers and Cluedo by the British people that you mentioned, which
yes.
you told me the name of the British people and the name of the company that makes Cluedo is the most Britishy ass word ever, because when you said it, you sounded so stereotypically British. It was just like hilarious to me.
I don't know what the big issue is.
It's not an issue.
Why this particular word invokes a higher sense of Britishiness to you than any other word I usually say.
It's all of the hard syllables in the British tone of language. So what is the name of this company that makes Cluedo, Morgan?
Waddington's. And I don't know why this is so funny. I can't understand why this is so funny. If you could see Janine now, she's bent double over her chair, giggling.
I hear you talk all the time. So it's one of those situations where your accent kind of gets lost to me. And then as soon as you said Waddington's, it just was like, oh yeah, he's British as well.
Oh, for God's sake. Well, yes, Waddington's make Cluedo. But Parker Brothers can make Clue as much as they want to.
Yes, yes.
I suppose. But we are talking about this movie.
Yes, we
are. Movie is an absolute delight, really. It is the kind of style of movie that comes around so infrequently anymore because it truly does not take itself seriously. And I mean, even the stupidest of comedies that come out today take themselves seriously. They still want to be stupid comedies. They still have that inherent, we are making a movie that has to be treated as real life. This wants to be pure entertainment.
Yes, it's incredibly silly, and it knows it. And just with the dialogue, it's very tongue-in-cheek.
It's half a spoof.
Full of innuendo and just very fun comedic dialogue that really gets you feeling like they're completely in on the joke.
Yeah, almost lyrical dialogue at times. I mean,
yeah,
Tim Curry feels like he could just monologue on and monologue on for ages in this movie.
Yes,
he's
detailing
all these things.
Yes. And even the accompanying score going on with his running around, yeah, is like so perfect.
But it feels all very lyrically written.
Yeah.
As though whoever wrote this movie, and I will get that up now. Oh, it might have been John Landis, actually. John Landis,
oh, yeah,
story, mm-hmm. Jonathan Lynn story and screenplay. So John Landis and Jonathan Lynn write it so, like I said, lyrically, musically, this kind of real swiftness to it that doesn't feel like real people speaking at all. It feels like a complete work of fiction, which is what this is.
Yeah,
it feels like something made up. It feels
yeah.
like something that is role-playing. Because isn't that what Cluedo is?
Yes, and that's what kind of mystery is. Mystery, that genre of kind of a murder mystery, is these kind of caricatures that fit these different kind of stereotype molds.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's really, really intelligent, really, given that it is, I think, a wonderful way of adapting a board game to screen. I mean, an easy way, because Cluedo does actually have a story point to it. It's not like a lot of board games where you'd almost have to craft your own story around the scenario of a game. You know, you do have a story with Cluedo. Somebody gets murdered in a big house. Who is the killer? That's all you need to, you know, it will be what it will be from there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whatever it will be, it changes quite entertainingly. In this movie, you get variation on the exact outcome of the movie itself, which I do quite like. But I do think it's such a clever way of adapting this board game, as well as being a complete riff on that particular genre, and like I said, half a spoof. Not a full spoof, because full spoofs are just inherently stupid and, you know, very much so don't, you know, can go into the fantastical. And this movie never goes into the fantastical. It stays in its own world really quite well. But I say half a spoof because, like you said, it is full of innuendo. It is full of these theatrically displayed emotions and the various endings and the title cards you get between the various endings say, well, it might have happened like that, but it could also happen like this. And then for 3 minutes, you get the variation of the ending.
Yes, which was a really fun thing I ended up discovering when this was actually released in theaters. This movie did not do well in theaters, but you know, when you had your Showtime listings in the newspaper, when you would go look up this movie, it would say either ending A, B, or C. So depending on what Showtime you picked, you would get a different ending every time. So that's how you were able to view the different endings. And then, of course, on release at home and on, you know, premium channels, that's how I saw it in streaming and DVD Blu-ray, you get all three endings and they have the little title cards explaining the different ways the endings could go. But I thought that was such a cool idea and so innovative, but the fact that people didn't really have fun with that or understand it really at the time was kind of disappointing to find out, because I thought that was such a fun concept to do for movie endings, especially a murder mystery and one that's based on a board game where you the killer is going to be different every time, depending on how the game goes. So that was a really fun concept. Yeah. So, I mean, I remember, like I said, discovering this movie, I was homesick from school. I think I was maybe like 11 or 12 or something. And I was homesick from school in bed, just watching TV. And then I saw this movie Clue and I'm like the board game. And so then I watched it and saw the three endings. And I thought, this is so fun. This is so smart. I just really enjoyed myself. I thought it was funny and silly and loved the snappy dialogue and the just how they did the endings, like I said. And yeah, it was just a really fun surprise. So and then kind of over the years realizing it kind of has this cult status, and then to kind of delve into it more, learning it didn't really do well when it was released in theaters, especially with the kind of different endings, people were kind of confused by that, I think. So it's really interesting.
I mean, I don't really know why you'd be confused about that, because just take it as a half a joke, you know. Yeah. It's not supposed to be taken seriously. You're supposed to have fun with this movie. I think that's what the movie's telling you to do, and I, you know, certainly did. I think it's a really very tight movie as well. You know, nothing in here is wasted. You are breezily introduced to your characters at the beginning. You haven't got a clue why they are in this house, who really has invited them all to this house. You don't know the real names, because they've all got the names of the characters from the game itself. They've all been kind of given them as pseudonyms, but you've got Tim Curry as the butler in the middle of it all.
Wadsworth, who's
seemingly invited them all here on behalf of somebody for an unknown reason. That reason is, of course, disclosed slightly later on in the movie, and it, I think, becomes really quite special when you realize that it's not just simply, oh, a group of people are in a house, there has been a murder, who's killed them. Because there's, they put genuine motivation for them. Not only one of them maybe wanting to kill the host, but why they're all there in the first place. They put genuine motivation. They give all of the characters this real desperate kind of need to cover
motivation. Yeah, the fact that they were able to craft a story around these probably very, you know, one-dimensional characters, I thought was really fun. They crafted this whole kind of Washington conspiracy type connection between all the characters.
I mean, it's very kind of, it's very condemning of government officials, isn't it, as a movie? Yeah. I think that's quite hilarious.
Really. Yeah, I mean, it does take place, what, 1954 New England?
Yeah, yeah. So. Oh, yeah, there's plenty of... I mean, how many times do they say communism was a red herring in this movie?
Yeah.
They must have said it in every ending, I think. It was a big point. Oh, no, we're just playing around with that. Somebody mentions not naming names to HUAC, you know, House Un-American Activities Committee.
Yeah.
So it's quite entertaining, really, given, you know, we know that at that time it obviously was a very paranoid time in
American government. Yeah, I think Wadsworth's story is around him being blackmailed because, and like, his wife was killed because she had friends who were socialists. Like,
yeah, something yeah. like that, which is just like, oh, okay, that's a bit much.
But... Yes, or she was being blackmailed, and I think she ended up, like, committing suicide or something like that because she couldn't stand the blackmail, and she was targeted because she had socialist friends or something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. Well, they're all being blackmailed, you know, yep. Mrs. Peacock, Miss Scarlet, Mrs. White, Professor Plum, Colonel Mustard, and Mr. Green. Why is it Mr. Green, Janine? It should be Reverend Green.
Yeah. Oh.
He should be a reverend. And I'm not to say that, like, yes, bring the church into everything, but he should be a reverend. That's the character. I thought that was...
Yeah.
If we're having Professor Plum be a professor...
I can't remember. I'm wondering if the American version. I wonder if the American version is Mr. Green. I've literally only.
It might be.
I only played Clue maybe like once or twice, like in high school. So I don't remember. And then I think even now the new version has kind of changed them even more. So yeah, I wonder. I think maybe the American version was always a Mr. Green.
Oh well, if it is, then fair enough. Oh, fair. I didn't. Know that. I just know it as Reverend
Green.
He's a churchman. He's a clergyman.
Ah.
He's an old man.
That's
as well.
A good thing. Colonel Mustard should.
I'm glad they gave crazy Colonel Mustard a mustache. Yes, I'm glad they gave Colonel Mustard a mustache. Although I really do think they could have just had them all dress in the colors.
That was always a thing that was like, oh, I want to see them in the corresponding colors, but I think the reason behind not doing that is because these were aliases that they were given and not their real names, so why would they dress?
But they knew these aliases before they arrived.
Yes, but it's like, why would they dress to match that? And I think I want to say their cars are the colors of their names.
Okay.
So you saw Miss Peacock had like a blue car, like a teal blue car. Miss Scarlet had a red car. So I think all of their cars were their corresponding like player colors.
I will let the movie off for having car colors then. But I think that could have been a stipulation of the letters they were all given would be to wear these.
Yes, things. I would have loved that because that's like one of my favorite parts just aesthetically of the game. That you have these people named for these colors and then they dress that way. You know, they did give Miss Peacock a little like feather kind of thing in her hat.
They so did.
She yes, had that kind of going for her. And I think Colonel Mustard had like a yellow tie. So I think they tried to incorporate it in little places with some of the characters.
Mr. Green being or acting like a very green person.
Yes, just very kind of scared and naive to things and like, I didn't do it. I told you I didn't do
the
it.
The amount of times he just says, because I didn't do it in this
yeah.
movie.
And Colonel Mustard is kind of an idiot.
Colonel Mustard's a massive idiot. Professor Plum is just a dangerous pervert.
Yes, he's totally pervy.
He's ridiculously so. Mrs. White is perhaps low-key my favorite.
Yeah,
in the entire movie.
A lot of people's favorite. Madeline Kahn is great.
It's mainly because it is Madeline Kahn who's able to just be so silly while seeming to be really serious, seeming to be really. She's almost the most intimidating one of the six of them.
Yes. Oh, she's very presented like this kind of Black Widow figure.
She is, but it's Madeline Kahn who is obviously just going to end up shouting something and acting a bit strangely, because that's what Madeline Kahn does. I was half expecting Madeline Kahn to actually be, or should have been, Yvette, because I just think of Madeline Kahn
in that kind of role.
Blazing Saddles.
Yeah.
And her in that, obviously, French maid outfit, putting on a stupid accent and dancing about, which is exactly what Yvette was doing in this
yes.
movie.
Yeah.
Who is Colleen Camp.
Yes.
Who I thought was great as well. Yeah. I mean, it's this level of just pure fun and pure whimsy that is so missed, I think, in so many movies. And we can have fun movies today, of course we can. We can have silly movies and stupid movies and movies that make fun of themselves. We can. But there is that period, you know, and it seems to be very much mid-80s to mid-90s of just whimsy, pure whimsy being front and center in a lot of things. I can think of something tonally like Honey, I Shrunk the Kids or something like that, which is quite similar, Tony, which is obviously just a nonsense movie. Takes itself seriously, but really doesn't take itself seriously.
Yes,
at
it's having
all.
Fun. The focus is just being entertaining. And I think being fully aware of kind of what this movie is doing and being self-aware that, yes, we know this premise is completely bonkers, but if we kind of put our all into it and have fun with it and wink at you every once in a while, you'll have fun with it too. So I totally get that vibe.
Perhaps also it's just a Tim Curry special, because this has always seemingly been what Tim Curry brought to movies, was the ridiculous over-theatricality of everything he was doing.
Yeah.
But just the, you can't help but love every second of it. You are completely enamoured by watching him. You hang on to his every word. I mean, the amount of lines he must have compared to everybody else in this movie is staggering as well, by the way, because he feels like he never shuts up, just going on and on and on.
Yes!
Explaining why they're there, explaining what's just happened, explaining what just
and
happened.
And every little tiny happened. Detail of every situation, like when he's going through, he knows who the killer is, let me go through the whole kind of story again, and them kind of following him around, and he's like, just to like make a long story short, and they're like, too late, you know, because he's just rattling
he's
on
been
about
cartoonishly sprinting around the house.
Yes, yeah.
With this ridiculous kind of fluty flitty score in the background.
Yes.
Going doo-loo-loo-loo-loo-loo-loo. And he's just and now the cook was stabbed in the kitchen. Sprint back out, sprint back out, sprint back out. And that's when we went back into the study. But they went through the secret passage. I love the fact the secret passages are in this as well.
Yeah.
I mean, you couldn't not have the secret.
And all the weapons as well, and how they were able to work these just random kind of weapons into the plot.
They were as well. They used every single weapon at one point, or every single weapon was used.
Was used.
At one point.
Mm-hmm.
All the secret passages were used. All the major rooms of, apart from the conservatory. Was the conservatory used? Oh, yes, it was.
Yes, it was. Mm-hmm.
Because Mr. Body, our supposed host, or our
blackmailer,
host,
and
blackmailer himself, he tried to escape himself, didn't he, out of the conservatory, but he couldn't. Yes. So yes, the conservatory was used. So all the rooms were used. It's wonderful, really. I really did enjoy this. I mean, it reminded me so much of how much I enjoy actually playing Cluedo and haven't played in so long.
I know, made me want to play.
Unfortunately, I think you can't play Cluedo with two people. It's like a three person and a bull kind of game because of the secret clue situation that you have to show people. You can't really do it with two people. But it reminds me that I think the best board game I ever played was a game of Cluedo years and years ago with my nan and granddad. Me, my brother, my nan and granddad. And it was when we were children. So my parents had gone away. And we were staying with my nan and granddad. And they like Cluedo. My nan is very much kind of murder mystery, Agatha Christie, Poirot kind of person, ridiculously so. She'll watch murder mystery shows all day, every day. And this is what she will do with her entire day.
Yeah.
And it'll just be like, oh, I've seen this episode of Poirot 14 times. Why you watching it? It's good, isn't it? Well, yes, it is. Okay. But we had this game of Cluedo, and I just remember it going on for ages and ages and ages because we were just all convinced of exactly what had happened. We all knew, four of us, exactly what had happened, and it was on the roll of the dice of who would get somewhere else first so they could drag the person closest to the room away so they could make the charge to the ballroom, it was.
Ooh.
So it was wonderful because we all, looking at each other going, yep, it's that, isn't it? It is that. Yeah, we just aren't in there yet.
Yeah, we just have to get there.
Obviously, you have to get there. Very, very fun. But I haven't played it in ages.
Yeah, no, I haven't played in years, a long time. Like, it was a game I never owned. I just played, like, at other people's houses. I think the first time I played, I was over at my friend's house after school and after we did homework. Her and me played a game with her parents, and that was like my first time ever playing it. So I don't even know if I could really remember the details of even how to play it.
You're more of a Monopoly head anyway.
Yes, I am.
because you're a twisted person.
I'm looking at my collection now.
I think the next time I play Cluedo, I should get everybody to actually role play as the characters from this movie. And just have them be themselves, which would be unfortunate for me, as obviously who am I always in Cluedo, Janine? You should be able to think about it. Think about it.
Hmm.
I'm Professor Plum. I'm always Professor Plum. Obviously,
that's who you always. Yeah. One. Okay. Oh yes.
It's the purple one, but. Which it would be a little bit unfortunate for me if I was to role play this situation, as I would just be touching people up all game, which is exactly what Christopher Lloyd does in this movie.
Yes, he's very touchy feely, a little too much so, but
far too much for anybody's good. I mean, he sets it up at one point when a police officer comes in to the house as just, oh no, you can't go in there. Why can't I go in there? It's like, please, I must go in there. No, you can't go in there. And then the police officer goes into the study, I think it is. And Christopher Lloyd's just set it all up that there's some fun times going on.
Oh, yes. That whole them having to, like, stage this interaction with these dead bodies. Because at this point, I think there's, like, three or four people dead. And they have, like, you know, puppet and like mime these bodies to like distract the cop. Yeah, it's pretty bad.
Through like snuggling on the couch with a dead body, but just conveniently
moving, you know, the hands and
moving your hand and putting your hand over the big bloody bruise on the forehead.
Yes, like the best was probably like in the curtain you see Colonel Mustard presumably making out with the dead cook, and Mrs. Peacock is on the other side of the cook holding her up and putting her arms and just like rubbing Colonel Mustard's back with her arm with her hands. And the dead body's just in between them. And you see how it looks. And then, like, they close up on them. And they're just like, like, they're so grossed out doing these motions. Oh, my God.
Well, Mrs. Peacock would have the back end of a dagger almost stabbing her in the eye at that point as well, because that's how the cook does die. I know we haven't really gone through the plot details of this movie, but I almost feel like it's not really necessary to.
No, because the characters
get picked off one by one. In terms of, or the side characters,
the ancillary characters. So yes, we open the movie with Wadsworth coming to the house. We have a cook there and a maid there. I also love the kind of running joke at the beginning that Wadsworth steps in dog poop, and then like as he goes throughout the house, people like make sniffing, like they can smell it, but they don't know where it's coming from, and it's Wadsworth because he got it on his shoe. So anytime he kind of enters the room with somebody and walks out, they're just like sniffing around, like, what is that smell? So yeah, he's
tiny little
up the
visual
house.
Gags like that that are carried
great.
On throughout this
yes.
movie. It's really
yes.
wonderful.
So. Yeah, he gets to the house. We have the maid and the cook there. And then one by one, our guests arrive. He tells them, yes, this is your alias. And they all show up and have dinner. And then slowly they realize, like, why they're there. We go over kind of what they're being blackmailed with. Some of them try to deny it. Some of them, you know, fess up to it. And then Mr. Body reveals that he's the one who's been blackmailing all of them. Wadsworth reveals that he's kind of been recording everything that's happening, and he's going to give it to the authorities. And Mr. Body convinces them, he gives them each a weapon from the game, and convinces them, well, if you just kill Wadsworth, then your secrets are safe. But, you know, obviously I'll still be able to blackmail you, but at least your secrets won't get out. Because even if Wadsworth tells the cops what I've done, you know, that your secrets will be exposed. So either you put me behind bars and your secrets are still exposed, or you keep your secrets, you know, with me and, you know, still have to pay me this blackmail money and no one will ever know. So he turns off the lights for one of them to take the chance to kill Wadsworth, and then Mr. Body ends up getting killed. So that's kind of what sets all the kind of murder mystery in motion.
It does. But who kills Mr. Body? Well, we don't know because the ending changes.
So then we have like a hitchhiker show up. We have a singing telegram girl show up. We have a cop show up. So we have all different characters kind of coming in, and they ultimately get to be the murder fodder for the rest of our story until Wadsworth kind of figures it out. And that's when we get our really fun finale of him kind of running around and explaining each step and motivation as to. And it's great that they were able to craft a story that up to a certain point would work every time for three different endings to be applied to it.
Yeah.
So there had to be some thought there to give everyone a motivation, to give everyone a moment to maybe not be in a room
that's the important thing. That's the clever thing, really, is they give, you know, the different endings, the three different endings, they give those three different murderers time in the movie where they're not around, but you don't realize that.
You're not thinking about that.
You don't think about that. It's a movie that I think works so well to rewatch, which is it's what not confuses me but saddens me, really, that it wouldn't have done well in theaters at the box office. Because why would you watch this movie and then not want to go and watch what, you know, you knew there was a different ending out there, because there was ending A, ending B, ending C. Why would you not want to go and see that? And then you'd rewatch all the first lot of the movie until like the last 10 minutes. And you'd be looking for things. You'd be thinking, wait, so I had this ending first, but does this ending work? Works so well for rewatchability. So well for rewatchability. That it does confuse me, but yeah, it saddens me that it wouldn't have done well at the box office. I think it works so well for that. Murder mysteries, okay, do tend to work well for rewatchability, because you can spot new things, you know, you can maybe try and figure it out for yourself if you like doing that kind of thing, or just like knowing what's going to happen and find and, you know, watch all these people looking try and figure it out again. But to actually have it have different endings, none of which are the definitive this is how it ended ending. We do get a, you know, a first, a second, and a third ending, obviously. You might assume the third ending is the real true ending, but it doesn't have to be.
No.
It doesn't have to be. I actually think I prefer the Miss Scarlet ending, because I like her motivation, and maybe it's because I'm a bit noirish in my sensibilities, and hers was a kind of almost a pimp situation, wasn't she? She was kind of procuring women for government officials to have their way with.
And then, you know, be motivated by keeping secrets and selling them to the highest bidder is kind of selling, ending motive.
I think that's the most kind of manipulative conspiracy one, I think, which I kind of, so I think I kind of like that one. I mean, the Miss Peacock one is, it feels more personal. It feels just more something that, like, she herself was almost panicking about her own situation.
Yeah.
So she did that. But I suppose that is in line with what Miss Peacock has been behaving like the entire movie. She's been screaming left, right, and center. And
yeah, I mean,
around.
I think it's a good turn in terms of just like, yeah, she seems kind of hysterical and kind of all over the place. And then for her to kind of be this measured killer by the end, I think is a good, is a fun bit of unexpected.
It is, but I still think it comes out of, because her situation is, isn't as kind of business savvy as Miss Scarlet's situation, is it?
Yeah.
So her situation is more personal. It's personal. More reactionary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that might be where I'm coming from that. Or the third ending, Janine, which ends itself in with a line that I think epitomizes this entire movie. And don't read too heavily into this particular ending line of, you know, clue at all. But that level of just absolute nonsense of a line of dialogue and a delivery of a line of dialogue is exactly, I think, what is wonderful about this movie. Do not take this seriously, because how can you take that particular line seriously? Janine, what is this third ending?
Yeah, so the third ending kind of implicates everyone. At least each person, aside from Mr. Green, kind of had a motivation for killing one of the people who come to the house. So they're all implicated, only for Mr. Green, who was seemingly pretty hysterical himself and very much kind of calling out his innocence the whole time, admits that his blackmailing was because he was a gay man, ultimately is revealed to be the hero of the story. He's like this undercover FBI agent. And he ends
who
up
takes a Christopher Reeve Superman level turn and stands himself up and puffs his chest out.
And I believe, and doesn't he take his glasses off? Yes. And Wadsworth kind of is revealed to be the biggest bad of all of them, because he is kind of the mastermind. I believe he was he kind of reveals himself to be the Mr. Body, the real Mr. Body. And he has the gun, he's threatening everybody, he's grandstanding, only for Mr. Green, who was this kind of pathetic, silly man who, you know, was out here talking about being blackmailed for being gay.
Stereotypical performance for most of the movie, though.
No, definitely not. Takes his glasses off, you know, stands straighter, pulls out a gun, and ends up disarming shooting Wadsworth, who's very impressed. And
he
revealing
was very impressed that he was able to figure it out. Yes.
And is well, he's also very impressed as he's dying with his shot, with how good his shot was. Then he reveals, yes, he's like was undercover FBI, and then all of the FBI forces bust in. And he kind of ends with how he saved the day. Now he's going to go sleep with his wife because he was not really gay. So he just kind of has to close.
We have to just hammer that home because the movie's set in 1954. And
yeah.
For some reason, this is still an issue.
Yeah. But also with
the line delivery of, I'm going to go and sleep with my wife.
And it's just very
like, okay.
Wink.
You ding. Do that.
Yes. But I think with this last ending, it's a lot of fun because everyone kind of plays a part. We get a very iconic moment when Mrs. White, where, you know, the flames on the sides of my face.
This is Madeline Kahn at her absolute best, I think. You can see, I mean, I get this a lot, obviously. I'm doing all these shows that we do, of course, every week. You end up completely losing your words at one point or another, and this is exactly what happens to Mrs. White in this particular moment. She gets so enraged, so annoyed, that all she can say is just flames in the side of my face, burning hot. And that's all she can do.
She can't, she's so angered that she just can't muster the words. Her emotions, how she plays it, the limited dialogue, the delivery is just so pitch perfect. It's so good. I also like that the previous two endings are actually foreshadowed fairly early on. Wadsworth gives a quote from a poet, I can't remember, like Tennyson or something, I can't remember what he says, and Colonel Mustard says, I prefer Kipling, and he quotes a line from him saying that women are more deadly than men or something like that.
Yeah.
So the fact that he's saying that women are more deadly than men, and then two of our endings are our two female characters in the story end up being kind of the main villain killers of the first two endings. So I like that it was foreshadowed in a kind of almost forgettable way. And then on a rewatch, you kind of catch that. So I thought that was kind of fun.
Yeah, but you know, these things happen in these kind of movies with these kind of stories. This is why this as a genre continues to just be so prevalent. It continues to be so popular as a genre of movies, of TV, of books, of everything. I mean, you think, oh, another murder mystery, but you can always, as long as you get a new setting and new characters and new motivations, the plot points, yes, okay, they're always going to be the same kind of structure, but it continues to just work. It continues to be very, very popular.
Yes, I mean,
and it is that inherent fondness of trying to figure out things, trying to pick out what clues you may be presented with that you don't know in the end. And when it is all, you know, the suspects gathered together in the one room at the end and Poirot goes around and looks at them all.
Yeah.
Columbo goes around and looks at them all and figures each one of them out. And then or Benoit Blanc does and tells us all who actually is the villain. We then go, yes, we like this. This is good. To a lesser extent, it's exactly what Velma does in Scooby-Doo.
Yeah.
It's always true. Velma who does it, by the way. Never anybody else. Always Velma. Always Velma who does it. But that's why you're the ghost, because you did this, and this is how you did it. And perfect. It's murder mystery, really.
Yeah,
without
it's a very
sometimes necessarily the murder.
Yeah, it's a very set formula, but if you can find, you know, fun ways to go about it, I think it works. Like, I think Rian Johnson, he's definitely done an amazing job bringing that genre back in a super fun way. Because I think even those Poirot movies, the newer ones, haven't done really well. But I think they're, you know, good enough, I guess, to get a third movie.
Yeah, I think they're going to keep making them. I think they do. I think they are successful. I don't think they are. They're not, and this is quite, I suppose, enjoyable, really, is they're not seemingly as popular as the Knives Out ones.
Yeah.
You know, they're not as kind of, they're not in the public's mindset as much as the Knives Out ones. But I suppose that's because they are adaptations. These stories have been around for decades and decades and decades. These are Agatha Christie things.
Yeah.
You know. So they're not actually new things. They're just adaptations. The Knives Out ones are obviously
kind of original,
entirely new stories with an entirely new character at the center of it all. Who, I mean, Benoit Blanc will have seemingly, you know, tens of movies at this point. It could go on for ages and ages, that entire series, and
yeah, they're
and
so
somebody
fun.
Else at some point could start playing Benoit Blanc. He has made a completely new murder mystery character on the level of a Poirot or a Miss Marple, a Columbo, something like that, that just takes over and becomes part of that genre's lexicon.
Yeah.
Which is wonderful that you get something like that, that you create something like that that becomes something that is already becoming what you can clearly see as a staple of that genre forever and ever. It's really great. And yeah. I like that those movies are able to also have fun with themselves, because they feel like a mix of the genuinely serious takes of the Agatha Christie stuff with something that is obviously very unserious, like Clue.
Yeah, like I feel like the Knives Out films are definitely a mix of something like this, Clue, and something like a Poirot-like story or movie. And this movie, I think, is a great direction to go with a mystery film for sure. The self-awareness, the quippy dialogue, the comedic aspects. Also, there's some kind of suspenseful moments, I think, that scene where Miss Scarlet's in the ballroom and she sees the curtain moving and she thinks maybe there's someone behind it. And, you know, the long kind of quiet walk up to the curtain only to realize it's just, you know, a broken window. So they do try to even throw in those suspenseful moments as well. When Yvette, the maid, is killed as well, she's kind of in a dark room. She's creeping up and then you see the noose go around her neck. And just kind of seeing the gloved hand, like hitting people with the various weapons and things like that. So they do play into those kind of creepy, hidden moments as well that you get in mystery. So there's a really great balance of the quickness and the comedy and the silliness and the self-awareness, but also the core aspects that you would want from a murder mystery. So I think this movie really has a great balance of the traditional kind of format, but doing something really fun and clever with it.
I mean, the Yvette's death is very suspenseful, yes, but it's kind of, the suspense is taken immediately away when she starts going, "Oh no, please don't kill me. I am French."
Oh no, she actually drops her accent because she was faking it the whole time.
But that's what she does throughout the entire movie, and I like the pure silliness of it. And she's just there, Professor Plum, Christopher Lloyd, just ogling her at every given opportunity because she's wearing this ridiculous level of push-up
Yes, it's a very stereotypical French maid outfit. Yes,
talking like that with a little black feather duster.
Yeah, she might as well have just been carrying that around the whole time. But yes, I mean, even with Professor Plum, with Miss Scarlet as well, when she kind of reveals he's blackmailed, she's like, you know, I own a hotel and have a phone service where gentlemen can call and get a female escort. And he's like, oh, what's the phone number?
Just like in front of everybody, no shame the man.
Yes, and then when they're looking at there's photographs or, you know, a film camera reel, like of Colonel Mustard's indiscretions with Yvette the maid, because he was his blackmail thing is he was a client of Miss Scarlet. So there's like, you know,
and photographs to work for Miss Scarlet.
Yes, there's photographs of Colonel Mustard in some very precarious positions, and so when they're kind of looking at them, you hear Mrs. White be like, nobody can get into that position. And Professor Plum is, oh, yes, you can. Let me show you. And he proceeds to like grab her and lay her down and like try to lift her leg, trying to like get her in this very scandalous position. She's like, get off me. So gross. Like, what?
We should not be making light of sexual predators, because Professor Plum definitely is that.
Yes, but however, I like that the women are very much like, no, stop.
They are, gross. Yes, they are. Go and the man has no shame.
Yes, I mean, even at the beginning. Lloyd,
he plays it so well.
Yes, I mean, even at the beginning, Miss Scarlet is stranded on the side of the road. He picks her up. They get to the house. And as they're waiting on the porch for someone to answer the door, he is like feeling up on her butt. And she's like, what the fuck? Yeah, dude is nasty. Yeah, obviously his whole blackmail thing is that he was fired, like he lost his license to practice medicine or whatever because he was getting it on with his female patients. Like, dude,
basically
nasty.
Very, very nasty. Very, very nasty.
Yeah, so I don't think you'd want to be this version of Professor
I wouldn't want to be this version of Professor Plum. It almost puts me off wanting to play as Professor Plum, because I always play as Professor Plum. I do. I don't even know who I would play as if it wasn't Professor Plum.
Well, I think you'd probably do Colonel Mustard, because you probably like his usually
I don't like yellow.
But I think in most versions of the game, he has a pretty fabulous mustache, right?
He does, and I almost want to go and check mine now to see if
to see.
There is a mustache. I mean, there won't be on the little playing piece. There won't be a mustache on that. It's too small for them to detail on a mustache. But, yeah, I'm pretty, he usually does have a mustache. I know Professor Plum wears glasses.
Yes, he does.
Reverend Green has obviously the Reverend's call.
Yeah, yes. I'll have to look at
Mr. Green in any US version, obviously. What relevance does he have then? Because it's, I think this is the thing, because it's like, Miss Scarlet is the kind of sultry, noirish temptress. Mrs. Peacock is the
kind of older kind lady, of stodgy old lady.
Or kind of, you almost think of, I think of Miss Peacock as a widow, you know, this that kind of aristocratic widow.
Okay.
That's what I think of Miss Peacock as. Mrs. White is just kind of like the old wise woman.
Okay.
Colonel Mustard is a colonel.
Yes.
He's all very prim and proper. Professor Plum's like a young, dashing science man. Reverend Green's a churchman. So what is Mr. Green? In the, is he just a dude? Because all the others are the same. All the others have a distinct personality to them.
We'll have to look. We'll have to literally look it up and see. Because I think also the characters got this whole new revamp in terms of their looks. I think they made them hotter and stuff in the newer game. I don't quite remember the professions of everybody. But yeah, we'll definitely should have looked that up prior to doing this. But Yeah, I mean, I thought this would definitely be a fun one. I'd been wanting to figure out a way to get you to watch this one for a while. Like, I thought maybe we do a murder mystery series, but I didn't think there were enough murder mysteries that maybe you hadn't seen to, like, make a full series around it. And then I thought about this game movie series. So, you know, we've gotten a variety of movies based around games, or, you know, have, you know, people playing games or in a game, yeah, or kind of, you know, being hunted like a game. So then why not close the series with the one I've kind of been wanting to do, where it's actually based on a game.
A board game adaptation, yes.
Yeah.
Real variety in the game movies series. I mean, we did start with a movie that was just about people playing a game.
Yeah.
Then it was people being the game.
Yes.
Then it was a game, a setup,
yeah,
and now it's based on a game. So very nice.
Oh, we also had other people playing a game. I guess.
Have I forgot one?
Yes, I think you forgot. I have bodies, forgot one, bodies, I? Bodies, I forgot
bodies, bodies, bodies. Yes, people playing a game in a silly way.
Yeah,
I did forget bodies, bodies, bodies. Don't know why I forgot bodies. Bodies.
Well, yeah. So I mean, difficult. Does that speak to your? Yeah. Does that speak to your ranking that you forgot bodies, bodies, bodies?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I mean, if I was to go off the top of my head now to rank the game movies series, it would be The Game at the top.
Ooh, it would, okay,
be, because I just think it was really good. It would probably be this as number two.
Okay.
Clue. It would probably be... Oh, see, this is where it just gets tough, because the other three are close. The other three are very close and very different. I don't know. I almost want to say from five up to three, Hunt, Tag, Bodies.
Okay.
But it could be anything. These last two are the top two, though, in that order. Okay. The Game and Clue, definitely.
Nice. Okay. But you enjoyed everything in the series?
Certainly did. I very often do.
I always aim to please with Morgan Hasn't Seen. However, next month, I don't know if that will be the case.
Because this is actually been a series of Morgan Hasn't Seen that we'll be doing next month. I mean, this game movie series has been wonderful. Clue itself that we've just talked about was a wonderful, wonderful movie. A delight of a movie. A movie that speaks to endless rewatchability, I think, just for pure fun.
Yes, it's a lot of fun.
And I do genuinely think a lot of that has to do with Tim Curry. I think Tim Curry always brings the rewatchability in his movies out.
Oh, yes, most definitely.
He is such a wonderful actor, of course, though he doesn't do that anymore, unfortunately,
yeah,
as we all know. But his movies are just wonderful. But next month, we wanted to have a bit of fun.
Yes.
We wanted to change up what Morgan Hasn't Seen is kind of about a little bit.
Yes, this is something we've never done on the show before, something I've kind of always wanted to do, but wasn't sure the best way to do it. I had some other ideas on how to do it, but The Flash is coming out. So,
as you know, for better or worse, The Flash, yes, is coming out.
We discussed the series, so it wasn't me springing this nonsense on you. You actually were very excited about the prospect of this idea. So we are going to be talking some fringe DC movies.
You obviously say fringe, I say notoriously bad DC movies.
Well, I think we agreed to call it fringe because the last movie in this series is not inherently bad. It kind of is a cult classic.
No, that's a fair, yes, that's a fair point.
Among fans of this movie, the last one that we're going to be doing. So we could call it inherently bad DC, but this last movie kind of, you know, is not really that bad. actually kind of enjoyable, and fans do actually really enjoy it. So, yes, in this series, we are going to be covering Steel.
Yes.
Green Lantern. Catwoman. And closing out the series with Constantine.
And yes, this is in honor of the release of The Flash.
Yes, which... because, I mean, it's going to be good, I think, you know.
But we don't want to watch it.
But we don't want to watch it because Ezra Miller is terrible. So, it's like, yeah.
So, why not fill out all the other gaps in our DC movie knowledge while we're at it?
Yeah. Exactly.
This was what I thought. It's not making fun of DC movies at all. This is not what this is going to be. Well, I mean, it will probably be making fun of the individual movies, but this is not... I don't want people to think, oh, well, The Flash is coming out, so Morgan hasn't seen, he's now just riffing on the entire history of DC movies to just say, we hate that. No. We don't. At all. We just think it's going to be funny, and because we don't really want to see The Flash, unfortunately, it's.
I think it's kind of fitting.
Going to be exciting. I was almost upset that I have seen Wes Craven's Swamp Thing.
Yeah, I mean that would have been a fun one to throw in the mix, but yeah, I think you probably avoided these. This is a time where you've avoided these movies for good reason.
For very good reason.
So I'm really excited to see your take and your thoughts on these movies. If we can even find anything good in here.
I'm genuinely excited for Steel, by the way.
Because, yes, I think I've only seen any of these movies like once, except for Catwoman. I think I saw it more than once because, you know, Schmodown studying. But yeah,
I am honestly really excited for Steel because I want to see what he does. I want to see if it's really
so
that
ridiculous,
that stiffly acted.
This is gonna be fun.
I enjoy Shaquille O'Neal, but for some reason he's become obviously such a well-respected, well-loved kind of basketball presenter and analyst and all these kind of things. But
no, and he's just seems like a good guy. Yeah, but
The man can't speak.
People love properly. Him. So yeah, we'll see early Shaq as Steel in this movie. Richard Roundtree, Ray J.
Wonderful. I mean, it's
the
just
man
great,
who
isn't it?
Launched 1,000 Kardashians. And Judd Nelson.
It's gonna be good. That's next week, I think. I think we're opening with Steel.
We are opening with Steel.
So there we go.
It
will be Fringe DC
for
the month of June on Morgan Hasn't Seen. Of course, it is not the only show we have on this podcast feed. We have Monday Madness, our chilled out topical kickback show on a Monday that you can also find on the It's a Wonderful Podcast YouTube channel in full video form. Subscribe, ding your notification bells over there, and of course subscribe to this podcast feed wherever you are listening here on all major podcast platforms for Monday Madness in just its audio form, as well as this show every Wednesday and every Friday. It's a Wonderful Podcast, the main show, celebrating old movies, discovering new old movies, something we always love to do here. We enjoy old movies. Old movies are our cup of tea,
Janine. Buddy.
And last week we had our big, exciting Seven Samurai and Magnificent Seven retrospective episode. It was wonderful to get back doing a big retrospective episode like that. We had a lot of fun with that. And this week, this Friday, we'll be talking 1959, Suddenly Last Summer, which is based on the Tennessee Williams play and Joseph Mankiewicz directed. It's a very heavy kind of movie, but not in a bad way. Not in a bad way, I'm impressed kind of way. Elizabeth Taylor, Catherine Hepburn, Monty Clift, very good stuff in there. But yes, Monday, Wednesday, Friday on all major podcast platforms. Subscribe, like I have said, and on the YouTube channel. You can, of course, also find us on Twitter at It's a Wonderful One. Find me on Twitter at The Purple Don, with a 3 instead of the E in the because, Janine.
3 is a magic number.
On Instagram and TikTok at The Purple Don. If you would like to join us on Patreon or donate in any way, there are links in the description to do that. We can't do what we do without that generous support. We love all our patrons dearly. So they are there if you would like to join us on their patreon.com/itsawonderfulone. Janine, all your murder mystery stuff is where?
You can find me at Janine_Debean on Twitter, Janine_Debean on Instagram and TikTok. If you want to get any merch for any of our shows, you can check the description for the link or search It's a Wonderful Podcast on teespring.com. And if you want to purchase any of my art in print form, you can find that at my Big Cartel shop at g9design.bigcartel.com.
Yes, well, there is only one thing left to do, and certainly do not forget to do what you said you were going to do at the very end of the episode. I'm not sure what impression to do. Perhaps in honour of Yvette, a ridiculous French accent.
Oh my gosh. A three, a four, a four.
Bye.
Bye.
Yeah.
I am your singing telegram.